Okay, welcome to Sundays. I don't want to speak too loudly and take up the whole space. Welcome to Sundays with the Modern. My name is Erin Starr-White. I'm an assistant curator of education here at the Modern. And for this program, it happens occasionally. We have Sundays with the Modern whenever we have a special exhibition and we want to look at it in more depth. Today, I've done something a little bit different and invited two of my colleagues who you see very often introducing other people to talk about the art. I thought it would be a real pleasure to have them come and talk about the work themselves. They're both artists. I'll start with Terry Thornton and do just a brief introduction. Terry, of course, is our curator of education here at the Modern and is an artist. I mentioned her work is conceptually based. She earned her Master's of Fine Arts degree from the University of Dallas in Irving. And Nathan Green is the other colleague that I've invited. Nathan earned his BFA from the University of Texas at Austin, and his work is painting-based, and both of them have shown extensively throughout the state. Nathan has also shown internationally recently. And so what they're going to do today is have really a dialogue in the galleries relating to the work, and I think we're going to hear some really great things. So I'll go ahead and turn it over to you all. Please turn off your cell phones. I forgot to mention. Thank you.
Do you want to start in here or, I mean, in there?
Let's go.
Okay.
Let's just go.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
What?
Fingers crossed.
It's going to be great.
It's going to be great. Oh, look, you got notes. Look at you.
Just to make sure we don't get way too off.
Right, yeah. Hi.
You want to start?
Sure, I'll start. Okay, Nathan and I talked about how we could do this, and we really have to be done in time for Nathan. He has the TAP group that comes at 2 to the museum, so we have to be done, which is a good thing because I tend to go on long. So it's good for me to have a limit here. And so we've picked out pieces that we feel like just sort of address. This is generally speaking. I don't want to get too caught up in this premise, but we decided we'd go through and look at things that we felt like dealt with representation and the way the 80s, generally speaking, against late 70s, 80s, started looking at and thinking about representation and how some of the artists in this exhibition, Urban Theater, Art in New York in the 1980s, how they started to, in fact, represent. And what does that mean, to represent versus to represent? So. We thought we'd kind of look at it in that way. We were going to start with Andy Warhol because the curator started with Andy Warhol. Michael Opping clearly put this here for a reason. Andy Warhol is an artist who really became known in the 60s. So for him to be here in this 80s show, there's got to be something to it. And in fact, what it is he had such a huge influence on many of the artists in this exhibition. And the way that I think of it, and just jump in here, Nathan, but I think it's kind of interesting. We're not going to so much talk about Julian Schnabel because he doesn't fit into that premise that we've given ourselves, but I really think it's interesting that Michael Opping has started with Andy Warhol and Julian Schnabel because while they were friends personally, they kind of represent the two poles of the work during this time period. Andy Warhol would, to my mind, be an artist working, using art in a more critical fashion. His work, I think, is more conceptual. He's working out of his head more, whereas I think Julian Schnabel is very much trying to bring back art as heroic. He's working in a very physical way. His work is visceral. This might be more about the questions. That might be more about the feelings. If you looked at them, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I was going to say there's also, with this work, there's a cool detachment. And I think we see this cool mm-hmm. detachment kind of throughout the entire exhibition. So, you know, though Warhol was integral in promoting people like Schnabel, Herring, Basquiat, I think, you know, people like Richard Prince and Cindy Sherman, they took a lot of cues from things yeah. that Warhol had established, you know, in the 60s.
Uh-huh.
And you know, one of the interesting things about this work is that, you know, before the 80s. It's like the 60s he was making his paintings, and then he kind of transitioned into making more films, and then all of a sudden the 80s come back, people are making paintings, and he's making this giant 9-foot squared painting. So it's something to scale that can battle with these kind of like giant heroic gestures of Schnabel. However, it's you know, it's cold, it's detached, it's mechanized. I do kind of love that there's a play of painting, you know, the way some of the hair almost looks like a wild brush stroke. I think it's really interesting, especially at this scale. You could almost think that that's a gesture, but I think this is more of Andy sort of toying with us than it is him emoting.
Right. In fact, he's holding back the emotions. He's almost giving us something that it creates a distance between us and the image, and the image happens to be him. So a distance between us and him, in a way.
Yeah, there's a quote. Will you hold this for a second?
Sure. Bob.
Who's Bob?
Bob Barker.
Oh. So here's a quote from Andy Warhol. "Like I always wanted Tab Hunter to play me in the story of my life. People would be much happier imagining that I was as handsome as Alan and Tab were. I mean, the real Bonnie and Clyde sure didn't look like Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty. Who wants the truth?" he says. That's what show business is for, to prove that it's not who you are that counts, but it's what they think you are. I think it's pretty interesting. We're looking at a self-portrait, and though it's his face, though he's staring straight at us, he's also giving us nothing. There's this coolness, there's this aloofness. I think him as a character in art history is pretty interesting, just because he's so sort of evasive through all through his entire career, you know, just barely gave you enough. And I think something about this work really talks about myth making, and you know, here he's making himself the myth Andy Warhol.
And you might think about, is it myth making on his part just for that reason alone, or is he in fact using that as a device to speak to the fact that that's happening in media? You know, that's happening in film, it's happening in television. And then, you know, of course, what we can't get past, because we're now in 2014, is looking at this and what, you know, Nathan just, the quote that he just read just is so striking, how that points to the fact that everybody constructs their own identity now in social media, right? You can be whoever you want to be. And that, in fact, is what matters. And maybe even there's some feeling that that's more real than the person you are. And I think that we'll see that there, that artists, as we go through, are addressing that. The artists we've chosen to look at for this tour are thinking in that way. You know, what is real, what isn't real, what's the more important presentation?
How to manipulate mass media, I think, is a theme that goes throughout all the artists that we're going to be talking about this afternoon.
Exactly.
The manipulation of mass media. You know, Warhol has a famous quote, "I'll be your mirror."
Yeah.
Using pop culture as sort of a raw material. He's reflecting what's happening in culture in this work. He's inserting himself into it, and I think a lot of artists are following that vein in some of the works we're going to talk about further.
Yeah, that's a really good way. And then maybe now that's a segue into Cindy Sherman. So let's go through. I mentioned Julian Schnabel. Like I said, that's kind of another tour for another time, but he's right here, and then we're going to walk into Cindy Sherman. Yeah, this is Douglas Crimp. I thought it would be good because the picture show.
Yeah, totally. That'd be great.
Okay, just to kind of make the point.
Yeah, thanks for doing that.
Yeah, just to make the point about representation, the idea of representation, and again, that is a huge philosophical, theoretical topic that I don't want to get bogged down with. I want the art to kind of direct what we're talking about and thinking about today. But just to set this up, there was a curator who did a show in 1977. His name's Douglas Crimp. It's called Pictures. It was at Artist Space. And the picture show has come to sort of look like what launched the 80s. And, of course, the 80s came from the 70s and went into the 90s. We're cutting it off for our purposes. But And he speaks to this notion because he was really fascinated by artists like Cindy Sherman, who I think wasn't actually in the show, but should have been probably, Longo, and some of the other picture generation artists that you'll hear about and that you'll see in this exhibition. And he said, representation has returned. And he's talking about in art, we're seeing representation again. It's returned, but not in the familiar guise of realism. So think about that, which seeks to resemble a prior existence, but as an autonomous, that, so represent a realism seeks to resemble a prior existence, but what he was seeing at the time and what we'll see in this work is a representation that instead has an autonomous function. He says experience governed by pictures or media like television, film, and such, like we were saying, next to these, firsthand experience begins to retreat. So think about, given that we can't escape the fact that we live now and we have our experience since the 80s, to look at, think about the idea of the firsthand experience retreating. Because in a way, we talk about how the computer has done that to us. You know, we stop having actual physical experiences, personal interactions. So I think that's kind of interesting to think about. And I'll just close with this, and then we'll talk about Sherman. He says, "What once seemed it once seemed that pictures had the function of interpreting reality. Now they have usurped reality." So think about that, the idea that this is, you know, Cindy Sherman is pointing to something, she's representing something, but in fact, she, like the film that she's referring to here, becomes the reality. This image, these images become the reality more than necessarily what the characters are doing in each of these images.
Yeah, and just to step back a little bit about the picture generation, this is, you know, baby boomers grew up in post-war America, grew up around advertisements, TV, films in a way that no other generation had before. These artists are starting to hijack some of these methods, these presentation methods or some of these tropes, mm-hmm. and use it for their own means. So they're really exploring, you know, these pictures, whether these pictures are coming through cinema or advertising or whatever, but
right.
they're exploring the image that's presented to them in culture, in the world. And so here we have, what is it, five works from Cindy Sherman's untitled film stills. Mm-hmm. These are, she worked on these from 77 until 80. She made over 69 of them. Each of these works sort of explores, you know, a certain typecast or a certain cliche that we see a female in cinema.
Mm-hmm.
These film stills aren't literal film stills. They don't refer to a specific film. These are from her imagination. This is her basically making a list of all of the cliches that she sees females in cinema and shooting these.
Mm-hmm.
From, you know, the housewife to the femme fatale to the, I don't know, give me some more examples of more cliches. There's 69 of them.
Yeah, and you know, they're from, like, the film noir or B-films, so... In a way, I'm not a film buff, so in a way, it takes me a minute to catch on that these aren't actual characters in a film. That I feel like I've seen them, but I haven't, because she's made them up. They're completely from her imagination. So she's presenting these tropes, but she's representing the male gaze. She's representing. The woman's role in society. She's representing. It's a critique, right?
Yeah, media's construction
right.
of femininity, like how it's. We can come in closer and look at these.
Yeah.
I mean, some of these look really. I think the reason they're so successful is because they look really familiar, and you know, like Terry was saying, film noir.
Yeah, they do. They look
psycho
familiar.
Thrillers.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
That's one of them that yeah. couldn't come up. Yeah, they do. They have, there's something familiar, and I think that's kind of interesting because by doing that, in a way, she's indicting the viewer. Because I recognize this, it means to some extent I've bought into that. You know, I'm implicated in a way because I recognize these images, even though they're not real images. I think I know them, and it's because I'm so familiar. You know, what has happened with representation, you know, it starts back, I said we weren't going to get into this too much, but it's kind of, I think everybody here is aware, but it's kind of important to maybe remind everybody that, you know, this goes all the way back to Plato and Aristotle. So you have Aristotle, who recognized that people need to, mimesis is important. You know, we need to copy things because that's how we learn about our world. You have Plato, who's a little more suspicious because he's concerned that the copy is going to overtake the real. So this conversation was already set up. And I think what Nathan said about these guys being baby boomers and being so affected by film and advertising and all of these things, bombarded really, and growing up, just like, you know, kids today grew up with computers. They don't know a world without them. You know, I can still see before. But these baby boomers, they grew up with media just bombarding you with images of who you were supposed to be, of who media said you were.
Which goes back to Andy Warhol and I'll Be Your Mirror. Like, these things function as mirrors. These are her seeing how, you know, her gender is represented in popular culture and films and cinema, and then kind of representing it to us, paring it down, but still like nailing it on the head with
absolutely. I mean, they're really phenomenal.
Specificity.
They're really phenomenal. Just how kind of they're not about being good photographs. They're about being good images. If you look at them, it's not about the photography, the quality of the photography. It's all about the image and what the image tells us. But every detail is attended to. I mean, you really believe it. You know, and I think, unfortunately, with a lot of art in general, but with Cindy Sherman, you know, you think, oh, I know her deal. She plays all the parts. That's her. She's always posing at, you know, you think you have all of the points, and then you stop looking at them, which is a real mistake. You know, they require time. There's a lot that will unfold if you continue to look at them. But, you know, in a post-colonial age, what happened with the 80s is these artists in particular began to say, we're not accepting media's image of us. You know, in order to break that that mold of, you know, there being this voice of authority. You'll see that in the work we're not going to talk about today, but say Barbara Kruger and Jenny Holzer. You know, it's this voice of authority. And you read those truisms, let's say, by Jenny Holzer, and you think, that sounds like somebody who knows what they're talking about is telling me it. That must be a fact. It must be real. So what they're doing by presenting that is calling it into question. They're putting you in a position to think, why do I believe that? And that's how representation has changed. So let's talk about...
That's great. Yeah, I don't have anything to add.
You think Prince?
Yeah.
Yeah. Prince is really good to look. Let's start with the, I think it's Untitled Cowboy.
Cowboy number 8, yeah.
Yeah, so which tells you it's number 8, so clearly he's done a series of these. And do you want to start out?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, so this work, Untitled Cowboy number 8, this is from a series Prince started. Let me look at my notes, I'm sorry. 80 to 84, and what these works are, they're re-photographs. So they're looking at a magazine ad, taking the text out of it, photographing it, representing it to us. These photographs are based off of the Marlboro County ad campaign that was, you know, hugely successful by Philip Morris, started in 64. It made the cowboy and the kind of the myth of the West, like, leaned on those kind of iconic views of those as a way to sell cigarettes. Here we have a work that is essentially a highly put together image that talks about our understanding of the myth of the American West. He's taken out the text so that we're not sold anything anymore, but then I think part of me thinks, like, I think I am still actually being sold something. Like, I still think this is a fake... This is a fake reality. This is a constructed reality. And part of what I love about this work is that, you know, like Terry was saying, the quality of the photograph, that's not totally what it's about. You get up to these, and the quality of these photographs, they're really, like, they're starting to fall apart. And I think you know, Prince is very much investigating that. Like, what happens if we run this thing through this machine again? And you can actually see how fake it is. It's like exposing how constructed this is.
Yeah, in other words, the image is more real than the experience. So if I can, you know, if he can relay what he wants to relay through the image, that's more real than actually being out there and doing this, which he's borrowing from advertising. And I'm just struck with this series, the Marlboro Men, is the way I think of them, because I grew up knowing about the Marlboro Men. I'm really struck by the fact that if I break this down, first of all, like Sherman, he gives us something that we assume we're seeing the Marlboro ad. If you're of a certain generation, you think you know that image. But there's nothing there to tell you that is, you know, the Surgeon General warning, none of that's there. Like Nathan was saying, he's removed all of that. So what does that do? Again, it indicts us. We know this image. And even if you're not of an age to understand it as that particular ad, you do know that you're being manipulated to believe that this is a representation of masculinity, right? Then when you find out that it was an ad, who is it an ad for? Are they trying to get women to smoke Marlboro cigarettes?
Right.
No, they want women to want men who smoke Marlboro cigarettes. Right, exactly. Exactly, Pat. That's what they're doing. I mean, and so he, again, like Sherman, he has me recognizing that I bought that. I believe that enough that I recognize what this is doing, even without the ad information on it.
And so then there's the question of, like, so is this image, or these, is Philip Morris, are they kind of like capturing a picture of a thing that's real, or are they creating something that's totally false in the first place? Like, what is this myth? Where is it from? Is this from corporate America? Is it from Madison Avenue? Or is this happening? I mean, I would think it would be happening here. I've never seen anything like that, you know?
I mean, it happens. That actually, you know, if you go west of here, there are people who still spend their days doing this. You know, so it does happen. It's not a reality that most people that are going to see this image are going to know about. It's going to be a vicarious experience for most. You know, not very many people are going to have personal experience, but it does happen. But yes, it's borrowing from something so masculine. But, you know, that's so, like you were pointing out about the fact that this image is degraded. And in a way, Prince is saying, okay, I'm not trying to trick you. I'm giving you, this is not a real photograph. And that's kind of an interesting notion, too, a real photograph. But, you know, you look at the Marlboro ad, you might actually feel like you can kind of smell the smells, you can feel the dust. You don't even get that. That's kind of amazing that by actually taking his, I guess, I don't even know what the process is, but some kind of camera that's fixed and photographing that ad, that he can have, that it can make that kind of shift in the image, that it can take out all the smells and the actual, you know, visceral feeling that the ad was banking on. So I think that's kind of interesting too, just by the degradation of it.
Yeah, in terms of, like, you know, images like these constructing our notions of what masculinity is, I kind of like chuckle to think about the, like, office worker who's, like, you know, down, like, in the break room smoking a cigarette and, like, picturing this in his head, like, feeling like a real cowboy. Like. But I also wanted to, so I was doing a little bit of research, printing out some stuff about Richard Prince, and I printed out this thing that had an ad on the side, which I feel, I mean, this is contemporary, so this is right here. Sailor Jerry's Rum. It's a rum ad, and it's just an image of two people, like, on a motorcycle going through the countryside, which, I mean, is the exact same thing. I mean, it's
yeah,
like,
when it works, why not repeat it? Yeah, we haven't escaped this. Just because the artist of the 80s decided to comment on it doesn't mean that we've gotten past it. It's all still happening. It's the reason that, you know, this whole notion of binaries, like there's male, female, there's good, there's bad, there's black, there's white. I mean, we can talk all day philosophically, theoretically about how we're so past that, but we're not, you know, of course. We're working on it, but we're not. But that's what art does. It brings these things to our attention. It creates these conversations.
So representing an archetype.
Yes.
Representing archetypes.
Right. Okay, cool. Good.
Yeah.
Getting us back on topic.
Back.
Yeah.
This with a lasso.
This little lasso, yeah. You need a lasso with me. This one is hysterical, I think. I mean, it's kind of, I don't know, there's something, dare I say it's so bad it's good or something, this, the monster trucks. And I, you may have lots to say about this. The only thing I can say about it is that in the same way that that ad was definitely for men, trying to get men to smoke cigarettes, I think the woman now is represented. We're in there. See us? We're standing here.
Just as big as the tire of the
right,
truck.
Right, yeah. Not even as big as the tire. So where is the man in this photograph? The man is the monster truck. So it's kind of interesting, like, even if that's that woman's truck.
Yeah, but don't you think that this is all very masculine, and they're putting them up there very sexual?
Oh, yeah. It's still, their audience is still male. They may have inserted the female, but the audience is still definitely male.
The truck is the male
member. Yeah. Exactly. It's totally the phallus. Exactly. That's exactly what it is. And it, yeah, I don't even know what to make of it. I think that when I see something like this, I mean, the image alone is kind of repulsive. So it's working in that way. But Prince doesn't just give us one of them. He repeats it, and he repeats it in this grid that's supposed to, I guess, create some kind of order out of this ridiculous chaos, to my mind.
Augmented hyper-masculinity.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, and that he's done it in these little images that you have to move in on. I don't want to be this close to that image, you know? But he makes me, like, get up here and look at it, you know? And he repeats it, and he puts it on a big sheet of paper, so it says that it's as important as an image that big.
Yeah,
I don't know.
True.
I just started, we hadn't really talked about that, but after I was thinking about that, I got all worked up over that one.
More than that one?
More than this one, yeah. This one is, of course, what I find interesting about this, this is another Prince. Do you want to introduce
sure,
it?
Sure, yeah, so it's a little bit of a backstory. It's a rephotograph again, so it's a thing that he's known for. This is a rephotograph of like a 1978 photograph of a young Brooke Shields. This photograph was, the initial photograph was taken, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's for, what was it? Pretty Baby, but it was for the promotion of Pretty Baby?
What my understanding, because there have been a couple of stories out there, and the one that I'm choosing to believe is that it was taken, Gary Gross was producing a book, and the book was The Woman in the Girl, or The Girl and the Woman, or something like that. So in other words, how you could start seeing a woman in the young girl. So clearly, he's given us a womanly image here. But then the Gross was doing that, and you have to say when you explain that, that Playboy was backing his project. Brooke Shields' mother agreed to it.
Correct. Signed the papers, agreed to it. Gary Gross owns this image. Brooke Shields, as she got older, wanted to buy this thing back.
Right.
Was really upset that this image can be used of her. Gross won the lawsuit. He keeps the image. Prince spoke with Gross, was able to rephotograph Gross's image.
He bought the image from
bought
Gross.
Bought the image.
Yeah, which was really crazy because Gross wouldn't give it to Shields, Brooke Shields, who, as she got older, decided that this was embarrassing. I think it was the same time she was doing those Calvin Klein ads, so the courts weren't taking her very seriously about it damaging her career. But yeah, so Prince bought it. He owns that image.
So purchased, rephotographed. Here we have the image of it.
Right. And the connection with Pretty Baby, since we kind of went far afield on that, is that the movie Pretty Baby, which was highly controversial and featured Brooke Shields as a young prostitute, I think, they used this image in some promotion. So that's where it's tied to that movie. It wasn't made for that movie, though, which is kind of interesting. But, yeah, it's just, and it, you know, what I find interesting about it, you might want to talk a little bit in just a second about how Prince originally showed this. You
sure.
Remember? Okay. But what I think is interesting here, in contrast to what Nathan will tell you about the original exhibition of this, is you can actually miss it. Like here, this was the one when we're getting ready for the show, there was a little concern, like how are people going to take this? It is an appropriation of something that existed. To my mind, it's highly historical. You know, at this point, it actually has already had its life. It's already kind of had its controversy. And we're seeing it almost like an artifact in a way to me. Not everybody agrees with me on that. But when you walk in, I actually talked to somebody who didn't see it. Because when you walk here, the first thing you see is the crotch shot by David Solly. And you can completely miss what was supposed to be.
There is something that happens, though, that this is colored by that.
Yes.
All of a sudden, it's like this image is shocking because this young girl is put into this kind of sexual connotation with the red lights. And I mean, then viewing it through the lens of like just this perspective, and it's like you can see these three things, which are all talking about sex and the politics of desire.
Which I think has to have been intentional by Michael Opping. I mean, he had to. He's really known for kind of doing it's where you get the long view. You know, you look and you see one thing in relation to another. So I can't imagine that he didn't know what he was doing when he set those two up. Well, tell us about
Sure. So this work, when it was first exhibited, Prince just rented a gallery or a space in Manhattan, showed this image, blew it up huge. It was the only work that was in the show. So if you walk into the show entitled Spiritual America, which is also the title of this work, this is the singular image printed at a, you know...
Was it printed large?
Yeah, wasn't it?
Does somebody know?
No. Shoot.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh?
Really?
But it felt large. Not to try to save you, but it felt large.
Right.
It was just, it was the only thing in the place.
Huh.
So it felt big. And I mean, it had a huge gravity. Yeah. No, I think that's kind of what, because he's actually, unlike the Marlboro Man, which he's blown up, he's shot the photograph. So I think the photograph is not much different in size, the original photograph. It may be a little smaller, but it's, you know, it was for a book, so I guess it would be smaller, right?
You're asking the wrong guy. I just said it was huge. Huge in my mind, right?
Yeah. But you know what I did find? Because I was looking, somebody had told me, a very reliable source, Dr. Colpitt at TCU, had said, you know, we think that Prince just directly photographs something. He just gives us something back. But in fact, this is highly manipulated to make it more tawny. I mean, is that
the red, that orange, and that red are not a part of the initial photograph, which is really funny. Like that, just those colors really change the way that you can read this whole thing.
And he crops it so she becomes bigger. You know, so he pretends to give it back to you, but he's actually manipulating you in the way he gives it back to you.
Which is interesting if you think about how initially things are manipulated in the first place. It's
right.
Like him doing that, this idea that the photograph is truth or something, I think is, you know, just a falsehood that all these artists are exploring. The fact that you can, you manipulate these things. They're all constructed. They're created. They're not reality. They're, you know, they're not mirrors.
But in a way, yeah, they're not. They pretend to be mirrors, but they're actually not. And then they become the reality. Because I'll guarantee you more of us have seen this. Well, then we have the original Gary Gross photograph. So this becomes a reality. And, of course, Gary Gross manipulated that situation to make her look, I mean, he's, you know, oiled her up. I mean, he did something to in his photograph. So it's you know, Baudrillard's idea of the copy, what they call hyperreal, a photograph of the, you know, and how far does that go?
And also, this is a really good example of another artist is like using the media for his own means, you know, like knowing that this is a very controversial subject. Mm-hmm. It's all throughout the news. He capitalizes on that and, you know, gets his name out there, whether it be negative or positive. I mean, I think it was a lot
no
of
news
negative
is bad
reviews,
news,
but,
right?
Yeah, totally.
If they spell your name right, then it's good. Which brings us to another artist who really, really knows how to work the system. Are we ready for that?
Yeah, sure. So we can walk through this gallery here to the Jeff Koons.
Yeah.
Hey, buddy.
Hey, look at
Terry.
You
nice
driving
to see
on. You too, always.
I'm sorry we're late.
Oh, it's all right. It's okay. You didn't. We really haven't gotten very far. I try to. I'm trying to make myself keep moving, but it's hard.
Yeah. Go get you
some coffee. Yeah, I think maybe I had too much coffee. That might be my problem. How are we doing on time?
So we're going to talk about these first, I think.
Okay, that sounds great. Do that, and then I'll talk a little bit about the vacuum cleaners maybe.
Okay, so like I was just saying, Richard Prince, using mass media, I think Jeff Koons, brilliant in terms of being able to utilize the machine that is mass media, popular culture, inserting himself into it. These are a group of ads. They were produced, 1988 and 89. They're lithographs. They were placed in Art Forum, Art in America, Flash Art, and Art News. These ads are promotion for gallery exhibitions, and I think they're hilarious.
They're troubling and hilarious, yeah. And they're, you know, what he does, I don't know if they're actually for exhibitions, because it tells you that he shows it.
All of his different dealers,
he
yeah.
shows you. So in a way, it's an ad of him. It's just an ad of me, you know.
Which is like, I very much can think Warhol making himself 9 feet by 9 feet. I mean, I think this is a step in a similar direction. It's like, how do you create the myth of yourself as the artist? You know, like, how can you insert yourself into the idea of the celebrity artist?
Right.
And, well, it's by making that a reality. It's by photographing that. It's by presenting your view of yourself to the world.
Constructing the view. I mean, it's completely... And then you start questioning, why do you want us to believe that you're this way? I mean, it's troubling. This one with the, you know, miniature horse coming out from between his legs and the two women and the cake.
Swimsuit models, him riding a donkey. She's presenting a cake to him.
And, you know, it's lithograph. I'm wondering if this is direct photograph. I mean, I think this one made me think that maybe there were some collage elements. Like, is he really there? Is he in a studio? All of which I think is kind of how these are made, I think kind of contributes to their meaning, whether we pick up on it, are conscious of it, or we just are sort of aware that there was something, it was made. You know, it was made, it was staged.
Yeah, and I think, like, you know, in looking at that Warhol self-portrait, I keep going back to that, but, you know, he's staring directly at us, but kind of giving us nothing. And in a similar way, like these Koons images, they're staring right at us, but, you know, it's like he's just hollow. You know, he's giving you absolutely nothing. It's like he's almost winking at you, which is, I think, a thing that his work does in general. It's like polarize people. Like, yeah, I work with students here at the museum, middle school and high school, and some of them get, like, actually upset at the work. And I think that's been his role since the beginning, is, like, upsetting people. Like,
what do they get upset about?
Just, like, equilibrium. I think, why is that in here? This work, why is this in here? I was just going to say, all of these, they feel like he's kind of like a trickster, and he knows something that we don't know. But he's staring right at us.
In a way, he's out-Warholed, or that seems to be his program, to out-Warhol Warhol, in terms of creating that persona. And I find that intriguing. I mean, it's a little bit like, this is who the world thinks I am. Okay, that's who I'll be. And I'll make my career on that. And in a way, Warhol did that too. I mean, what is that quote that they used in the panel, they mentioned the panel the other night, Warhol said, I'm deeply superficial.
Yeah.
You know, that's not the end of it. You can't not think about that. You can't think, no, actually, I think you must be brilliant because you said that. It doesn't leave your head. It stays in your head. I think that's what Jeff Koons says. He gets in your head. And no matter how you try, you can't get him out of there. You know, these are really provocative. There's the only thing provocative about the vacuum cleaners, the new, and I don't know what the full title is. It starts with the new, which was a series he did. What's provocative about that, that's art talking to art. That's art saying, Duchamp already created the ready-made. I'm going to one-up. So in a way, it's like... Koons, he's presenting supposedly himself, but he's representing art, I think, when he's...
Or just trying to represent himself as opulent or represent himself as a leader to the...
This one is so wrong.
Banality,
yeah.
Teaching the youth that banality is the savior.
Exploit the masses. These are the lessons for school. And I think these are really interesting, and I hadn't thought about this until Nathan and I started talking about doing this tour. I think these are really interesting in relationship to the Shermans. I'd invite you to spend a lot of time with these, not just dismiss them. Make yourself look at them. And then think about that in relation to the way Sherman is using her person, her image, as somebody else. He's using his image as him, maybe.
Or maybe like our worst sort of characterization of him. He's already beat us to the punch and like showed us what that is.
Like. Exactly. It's a little bit like the oppressed using the language of the oppressor,
sure.
But in a really perverse way. Like, not to a good end. Well, I guess it is to a good end. He's a very famous artist who I think right now has a, is it still up?
His, I think it just closed.
Just closed at the Whitney retrospective, the last show they have in their current building before they move down to Chelsea, which is no small thing. But there's no, I mean, he is a huge figure in the art world. He matters greatly, no matter how you feel about him.
And just the fact that these were in magazines, too. It's like you would just come across these. It's like, you know, it's almost a joke of self-promotion. It's like he's taking it to the furthest. He's exaggerating it and twisting it to the furthest degree where it becomes almost like disgusting slash humorous.
Yeah, exactly. He's sort of invite. I mean, it's to me, this is early on. I was talking about that, you know, one using more kind of maybe the Picasso of art is heroic, you know, art for art's sake versus the Duchampian really being critical, thinking about, you know, what is art? Why do we accept that? What's real? What have we been kind of, what bill of goods have we been sold? Definitely Koons is in the Duchampian camp. And this brings us to the vacuum cleaners, the new. Clearly, this is a ready-made, right? Except he's taking it, he's out Duchamp to Duchamp in a way, because he's not just presenting us with, he's not re-presenting vacuum cleaners, he's re-presenting art, the art that just preceded him. He's looking at minimalism. You know, it's spare, it has the industrial-made feel.
Right, there's no touch. These aren't
molding
anything.
Right.
You can't see the artist's hand. There's no gesture. It's all about this machine-made, this precise.
Which is really interesting. That makes me think. It just occurred to me, you don't see the artist's hand in Koons's work, so he supplements that by supposedly giving you him in these ads.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of interesting. I hadn't thought about that before. There's something about this piece that just sings. I don't know what it is. When I walked in, quite honestly, the first thing, Nathan and I were like, what really got your attention when you came in trying to decide how we'd talk about this today? I don't want this to be it, but this is the one that when I walked in, I was like, oh my God, it's as good as it is. It's that good. And it does, it just sings that lighting from below. I'm sure that's some kind of display trick that is, you know, people who do display know that that's a really common device. But he's not just referencing minimalism. Clearly, I think Erin pointed out in one of her tours, he's referencing Dan Flavin. I mean, you can't use a fluorescent tube light in art without referencing Dan Flavin.
Which I can't help but think that this is like such a jab, you know? Using this mode that we've established as art that was challenging at the time, but now we've accepted. Dan Flavin is an artist. This is an expression of creativity. Donald Judd, an artist, expression of creativity.
The stacked, yeah.
You know, they've built themselves from the industrial into the art world, and now he's like collapsing it into the commercial. So he's like using these things as a, you know, stage to talk about these vacuum cleaners. Like he's bringing them back down.
I mean, it begs the question, what happens when the provocative is accepted? Does it have any life left? Which Jeff Koons should be asking. I mean, clearly he's provoking us with his work. So what happens when we're all like, oh yeah, I love Jeff Koons. There's nothing better to go and see than Jeff Koons. You know, Jeff Koons doesn't upset us anymore. What's the power of the work? This light, I was reading Nicholas Borio talking about Koons's work, and he said it has a halo, but without the aura. And I, when I I immediately thought about this piece. That has a halo, almost literally. But does it have the aura of the halo? I mean, some would say yes, absolutely it does. I think what is powerful about Kuntz's work is the emptiness.
Emptiness, she said.
Yeah, I think what's powerful about it is the emptiness. Mm-hmm. I mean, some what's that?
Nice.
Yes. That's good, yeah. Elaborate on that.
Which is, so it's important to know that when this was exhibited for the first time, it was at the new museum, and these were the newest models of vacuums. Behind this, there was a fluorescent sign that said, "The New." So this was like exactly what you'd see on a storefront of like a JCPenney or Dillard's or something like that. So to put these things in this display case in front of a museum, I think, said something very different. Now, looking back, I think we have the hindsight. Or maybe we're looking into it, but I don't know. Vacuous is pretty, it's a pretty interesting notion thinking about this because it is kind of an empty gesture. It's kind of a move.
Yeah, I've never heard anybody say that. That's so perfect. Yeah, clearly, in the few minutes I've known her, I agree with you. I think she's smart. But, you know, the same,
I want to say one more thing about this and we can move on. But
yeah.
So Michael Oppink said something really funny about this work. And he was, speaking this in relation to minimalism and how it was so clean and precise and tidy. And he was like, you know, what's cleaner than a vacuum cleaner that's never been used before? Like, nothing is cleaner than that. So I think that's a...
I think that definitely he is not above the pun. I think the pun would be right there in his lexicon for sure. The Buster Keaton, I think it's important to note that this isn't just an image of Buster Keaton on a horse. It is a figurine, a little tchotchka, a puttum that has been enlarged. So scale becomes a way to talk, to make it art in a way. The basketball, I mean, to me, this was another conversation Nathan and I were having, is what is it, you know whenever your students are getting upset, like, why is that art? And it's, you know, whereas Duchamp questioned art, like Duchamp was saying, a urinal can be art because I said it's art. I signed it, I put it in the context of art, so it's art. In a way, Kuntz is taking the ordinary, kind of like Duchamp, but I think his motive is different. For one thing, he doesn't need to do that. Duchamp already did it. But
these are much more theatrical. Like, he's adding theatrics to it. Like,
display.
Very similar to his self-portrait.
Yes,
like.
Exactly. The theater, the title of the show, the Urban Theater, Kuntz is a real example of that. I think that's right. But he's taking the ordinary and making it extraordinary with these works, for example. And even this one, if you think of it as just being a figurine. And I think he's doing that with himself. I think he knows he's an ordinary guy. He's nobody particularly special until he said he was special.
Do we tell him the story about the critics at the bar?
Oh, my gosh. It's going to be recorded. But I read it. It's
okay.
Out there. Okay, Jerry Saltz, a critic in New York, was talking about somebody. Did you read this as well, Hyde? It was just before this show came out. I read it. And children in the gallery. He said that he and another critic two other critics were at a bar one night. And this is early in Kuntz's career. And Kuntz had just had a show. I don't know if there hadn't been much of a response or if the response was, I don't know any of that. But he walked up to these three guys and began to punch himself in the face, full on, punching himself in the face and yelling at these guys, I'm a fucking genius. And one of the critics looked at him and said, yeah, Jeff, you are. I mean, he's in their head. You know, that's it. They're not getting rid of him. He's now in their head. They can't help but think about Jeff Kuntz and the work of Jeff Kuntz. Ooh, I kind of got chills telling that story. I don't... Ugh. But this idea of representation or representing, the idea of taking something and representing it, manipulating in this case pretty much directly there, little theatrics here, that idea of representing, Levine?
Sure.
You want to talk about this some more?
Yeah, maybe just for a second.
Oh,
So you said that was your favorite work in the show. I think I've seen a million images of these, this body of work, the Equilibrium series. They're always interesting looking. Seeing it in real life, I was actually shocked how amazing it is. I think I would encourage you guys to come closer and check
it's
it out, moved. Walk around a little bit, yeah. Try to give it like a safe distance, but
supposed to be centered.
Duchampian, ready-made, taking something from the real world, plucking it, changing its context, putting it into the art context. But here we're sort of like reworking what a vitrine is or what a pedestal is. You know, the vacuum cleaners are encased in this pedestal. This ball's encased in this. We can tell that it's water. It's almost like it's got this magical quality to it. You don't really understand how it's suspended. It's in this kind of like womb-like scenario that is untouched by the real world. I think what I like about this work over these is I feel like there is kind of like a punchline, you know, like the vacuous or something, where it's like, oh, the point of it is this, and it's summed up into a pun or something.
Right.
Like this one, I don't think there is that. I think, you know, you could think about this material like, what is a basketball? How does it usually exist? It's moving, it's bouncing, it's never still. I don't think that there's like a...
it's frozen, yeah.
Yeah, it's frozen, but I don't think that there's a... There's something, it's not something that you get out of it. I think it's just representing this thing from the real world in this kind of magical quality.
Yeah. Yeah, just taking something very ordinary and making it extraordinary, making us believe that it's worth our while to stand here and look at it and think about it, that it's that it deserves to be in a museum. I mean, I deserve to be, you know, a famous artist. It deserves to be in a museum. Is Dr. J the same as Magic Johnson? Is that the same? Just Julius Erving, okay. That doesn't work then. I thought you said magic. I was like, okay. Yeah, it's a little bit like, and it is funny to me that this show is so historical. It is a little bit like getting to see this thing. I think I've seen one before, and I was amazed, but it's still amazing. It's actually supposed to be in the center, and that's bugging me, I'm telling you.
But I get more than 2 feet close to it.
If it moves, and they have to really, it's a really methodical procedure of getting it back in place. So I think somebody's going to have to do that.
I think I read an interview with Kuhn's talking about these works, too, that these balls, like, slowly sink. Mm-hmm. And he talked about, like... you know, that's the death of this object. It's even though this thing is frozen, that it's still moving. It's just moving at a speed that's slower than we can recognize and how. So there's that also.
Right, and you don't, I mean, because he set us up to not believe that he could possibly be sincere about anything, you don't take that seriously, but I wonder.
Puts it into it, yeah.
I wonder if he doesn't feel like that or just feel, period.
Moving on.
Yes.
It's funny when you're talking about declaring his genius, where I consider these ready-mades, but also he iconographized these
yes.
by placing them in these vitrines, and that is the entire piece.
Mm-hmm.
So he made them holy relics.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that.
Not just saying, like, that's art, but
right.
this is art, but frame it.
Yeah, I'm setting you up for it. I'm going to put those lights on. Yeah, yeah. That's
and then they
right.
become, like, icons, they're time capsules. You know, it's like they...
Uh-huh.
He has frozen these things
yeah,
and made them symbols.
Yeah, that relic idea is, and that is kind of how it feels. You know, when you get to see this in person, it's like, oh, I get to see it. How are we doing?
54.
Okay.
So he did the same thing with himself?
That's what I think, yeah.
Yeah.
Very.
He made
yeah.
himself a star.
Yeah, like that. You're right. But he kind of, it's very complex. I mean, I'll guarantee you, no matter how you feel about this work, you're not going to stop thinking about him and it. You know, he's in your head.
It's an earworm.
It is an earworm, exactly. It's going to play over and over in your head. I think we have about 6 minutes left, and there were two more pieces we wanted to talk about. Is that about right? Okay. So.
Well,
if we go in there, we're going to have Laurie Anderson.
Yeah, let's just do this one.
Okay. All right. All right. We're going to skip Sherry Levine, but clearly when you look at the billiard table and you read the wall text, you'll see that it's taken from a famous painting. So think about that notion of representation, representing with that. But we're going to finish up here with Alan McCollum. Do you want to start, Nathan, or what do you want?
Sure.
I'll jump in, I'm sorry.
Okay, sure. This is Alan McCollum's work. The title is, the Plaster Surrogates. He began the series, I think, in 77 or some, the surrogate paintings. These are plastic surrogate, which are kind of the next phase of surrogate paintings. And what they're always in multiples like this. The first time he did it as a single piece, a surrogate painting. And he didn't like the fact that that people saw it as an object. So he wanted you really to see it as this, you know, as paintings, as this field of images. So,
which is thinking about, just to step back, mm-hmm. He just talked, the Tuesday evening lecture series, which if you guys don't know about it, every Tuesday, 7 p.m., lecture here up until November
18th. That's our last one, yeah.
He was the second lecture series, and he was talking about the beginning of this work and trying to make kind of like a symbol, like how do you represent painting without it actually being literally a painting? He talked about symbol creation. Like you see a tooth and you know that the tooth stands for the dentist. He wants to make a similar sign that stands for painting. And that sign is what became this surrogate series. And the surrogate series are a framed, matted blackness. These are kind of shorthands for what a picture can be, but leaving the actual picture out of it. So it's just, it's this object that represents this thing that we understand as painting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he said literally these are signs for paintings. That's what he was trying to do. They become, in the way he has them framed and matted, it might be a sign for a photograph, a sign for a picture. It's a sign for art, in a way. A sign for, you guys want to come in? I know I'm mic'd, but I feel like with Laurie Anderson and her drum machine outfit in there, I can't. He felt like that. What happened was he began to see on television. He'd be watching television, and this is kind of a funny story. But his dad was a child actor. And so his father, every once in a while as a kid, he'd be watching a movie and he would see his dad in the background. He always played these figures in the background. So he began to, his attention was directed into the scene as opposed to necessarily what's happening up front. It's being presented as so that you're paying attention to the action, right? But he's looking past that. And he began to notice in that, as an artist, he began to notice, he was kind of geared to look back. He started noticing how art was represented in films and television shows. You couldn't tell what it was. It didn't matter what it was. It was a frame, and you knew that that meant there was art in that space. There was an image. So he began to make these signs for art. And
in a mechanized process, back to Warhol, like these things that Warhol established so long ago, it's this mechanized process of making these multiples. However, it's really important to realize that these are not multiples because none of them are repeated. So they're each an individual, I think, with a combination of size and color treatment. Nothing is repeated within this grid.
Right.
I understood what he said.
Yeah. That's
so they're each individuals that make up this kind of cluster that gives us nothing but talks about what it is to read something as a picture.
Yeah. So he's representing something to us. He's just giving something back to us that already exists in the world, but he's representing the notion of art, the idea of art, and what is it that we come to art for, and where do we find meaning in art? That's one of the things that really touched me, is he talked about the idea that where is the meaning in art? Maybe the meaning in art is a culmination, and this is that idea of individuals making up mass. He said, maybe the meaning in art is the culmination of all the meanings, the different meanings that are brought to it by all the viewers that see it. And he's really, you know, this idea of multiples is important to him because this, and this is very much in line with the thinking of the day, this post-colonial idea, this non-binary idea, that there isn't one way, there isn't a single right. The artist is not a genius. We don't want to put anybody on a pedestal. World War II told us that's a dangerous thing to do. And he, like a lot of artists, are that's in their DNA almost. I mean, that's something they were brought up with, and it's critical to him. He said something in the lecture the other night that was kind of funny, but it was profound at the same time. The idea of the single to him equating to somebody like Hitler. Like, you can't afford to have a single. You can't have one notion of beauty. You can't have one notion of genius. You can't. And the where we get those single notions is this kind of this colonial, this colonizing notion of, you know, somebody comes in and tells the people who they are and what they're going to be. And it's really critical to him that he gives you, and that you, you know, when you see this initially, it's just, it's almost like a cloud of these, and you just assume they're all the same. It's one-liner. Like, how much could you really think about or look at that? But then when you start recognizing, like Nathan was saying, that every one of them's individual, that becomes critical. The idea of individuals within
the craft. And that's where you can make meaning, I think.
That's right, and that's where the meaning starts to happen. It's also this idea of, you know, he's talked about the idea of being a little obsessed with death or absence, and I don't think you can look at this work without thinking about that either. He talks about, you know, he's making all these casts. It's like these things, he's kind of creating it impossible for him to ever be gone because he has all these things, these molds that exist after him. You know, if he keeps creating these casts, if he keeps casting these things from life, does he somehow, do they stand in for what's absent? Do they prolong life? And he's given us nothing to look at.
I mean, that's what I think is so interesting. It's like, what the image is the absence of anything.
Right. It's art about nothing. Okay, we're out of time. I just want, with this, in talking about how he is representing, it's a representation of art. I really think it's curious as to how these other paintings work in the presence of this piece. Like, when you hang this in a gallery with other paintings that are to be looked into, and they have a subject, what happens to that when you start thinking in the way of Alan McCollum and representation? So.
I don't have any closing thoughts.
That's it. Thank you.
Thanks.